Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we find ourselves at Steven Spielberg's Bridge of Spies, a period piece full of overcoats, intrigue, and Tom Hanks. Speaking of whom, in our second segment, we'll go way back in time and talk about the long and varied career of Tom Hanks, who will always be a man in a bad wig and a polyester dress to me. And as always, we will close the show with what's making us happy this week, so don't go away.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out the How to Do Everything podcast with Mike and Ian. Among other things, they help listeners find water in the desert, defend against monsters, and play a game of crud. Mike and Ian are here for you. How to Do Everything is modern life lessons from NPR. Find it now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We have spies and gumps on this week's show, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week, pulled away from working on the actual news, is Audie Cornish. Audie, what do you do at NPR?
I am a host at All Things Considered.
Wow, you sure are. And yet, it is always a delight when we can corrupt a real live radio person into our theater of the absurd. Mm-hmm. And this week we are starting with Bridge of Spies, a new, very classy Steven Spielberg drama based on real events in which Tom Hanks plays an American lawyer who winds up negotiating a Cold War era swap of a captured Russian spy for a captured American U-2 pilot. Is that a fair rundown?
That is it. That's the
That
plot.
Is a fair rundown. By my count, this is the fourth major Spielberg-Hanks collaboration after The Terminal, Saving Private Ryan, and Catch Me If You Can. Audie, what did you think of this wonderful movie?
First of all, I don't know why you mentioned The Terminal. I think that is better forgotten on that list of, movies in that collaboration.
Look, I'm just giving the credits.
You're giving the facts. All right. Very briefly, I have to say, you've talked about this in the past, about the difference between something being not good or you don't like it or it's not for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And spy movies are not for me. So yeah. I just want to say, even like the biggest, baddest Bonds for me, I'm kind of like, meh, the suits were good. And I come to this with a little bit of a deficit. And I thought it was old-fashioned.
That is exactly the word that was in my mind.
I have old-fashioned
right
written
there,
down.
Yeah. Right there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And there, I noticed a lot of reviews for it are a little bit apologetic. Like, there's a little strain in the reviews that are along the lines of like, well, I mean, maybe it's just me, but I kind of like this filmmaking, you know?
Yeah.
And you're just like, okay, I get it.
Sure.
And some of that old-fashionedness was charming. Some of it was stale. All of it, I think, was carried very ably and well by Tom Hanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a well-executed movie.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, Steven Spielberg knows how to make movies, and so does Tom Hanks, and so does Janusz Kaminski, who's the DP for this movie, and all the Spielberg movies back to, like, Saving Private Ryan. But I don't know. Glenn, what did you think?
This is, to me, a Thanksgiving movie, and I call it that not because of when it comes out, but because when you sit down at the table on Thanksgiving and you're there with people with whom you share blood but not necessarily a whole hell of a lot else in common, and they are 10, 20, 30, 40 years older than you, and you can't talk about politics and you can't talk about religion, and if you're me, you can't talk about sports. You need to talk about something, and it's ideally something that they've seen and they've liked, and that's this movie. This is the definition of mainstream. This film, apart from some little things, could have been made in 1962.
Oh, yeah.
Everything from the stolidness of the Tom Hanks character to the fact that Amy Ryan is given nothing to do.
Well, she was playing Donna Reed, I thought.
Yes.
Amy Ryan is playing the wife of the Tom Hanks character, and that is all there is to that character.
And as you said,
Amy Ryan.
I know, it was a waste. I like poured my drink out on the floor of the movie theater. This one's for my homie. Amy Ryan, she needed more to do.
When you make historical fiction, you expect some contemporary sensibility to kind of leech into it. I mean, Mad Men is filled with that, right? You can kind of feel Matthew Weiner just sort of commenting and poking you in the ribs when there's a pregnant woman smoking a cigarette. And the fact that Spielberg is like the poster child of nostalgia, and that the Coens came in to help punch up the script, and they are such stylists, you don't get any of that there. Again, well executed, I would not call it a spy thriller, more like a spy tenser. Because you get a little tense. You get a little tense now and then.
I think I would argue that the final sequence, the part that actually takes place on the Bridge of Spies, is admirably tense, is well put together, and is very suspenseful, although by then you've been through a great, great deal of setup. And I do think, in terms of what you said about commenting on contemporary themes, I think there's clearly supposed to be a, I believe it was Dana Stevens argued this in Slate, that there's a relevance to the treatment of this captured Russian spy with conversations we have now about what kinds of constitutional protections should be available to people who are suspected of terrorism and other similar things. So you can see parallels, but I'm not sure that commenting on those things is that interesting to me. It seems kind of flat.
I guess what I was looking for was some kind of take on these events, you know, some a point of view on these events, as opposed to just let's tell the story straight.
Stephen, how about you?
It felt very much like a paint by numbers historical fiction movie. I mean, right down to like the first thing the commies take is your color palette. So you depict, you know, East Berlin in dark blues and grays and grimness. I had a sense that we were going to kind of come down on this movie collectively the way I did, which is I like it, but here are all the things I can nitpick about it, where it ultimately is going to make it sound like we didn't like it. The old-fashionedness of this movie extends beyond the subject matter. Tom Hanks is playing Jimmy Stewart, playing James B. Donovan. It's like an action movie, but like where the hero's weapon is his integrity. And so I found that a little flat.
This is the kind of movie that I find very hard to comment on, because it's fine, right? It's everybody who makes this movie, who made this movie, knows how to make movies. And so there are certain sequences that I think are particularly nicely carried off. There's an encounter between Tom Hanks and a bunch of young men after he's in Berlin that sort of becomes unexpected and a little bit complicated as to how he's going to navigate it. I also really like the performance from Mark Rylance, who plays the captured Russian spy. That is, to me, the most interesting and kind of surprising performance in the movie in some ways, because there is an effort to have some sympathy for him. And yet, I mean, he's not a hero, right? He's a guy, and he's a guy like Tom Hanks is a guy. And they try very hard to sort of draw some of those parallels out. But what this made me think about, first of all, it made me think about a thing that we talked about Spielberg when we covered Lincoln, which is my kind of regret that he's retreated entirely from joy, you know, and to me hasn't made a really joyful movie since Catch Me If You Can, which is by the way, is a really terrific movie that I wish people talked about more as a really terrific movie, because
it holds up.
It's so much fun. I watched it again this weekend. It's so much fun. And it's set in very much the same time period and has Tom Hanks actually playing in some ways a very similar guy. And yet it has this mischief and joy and fun to it that, boy, Stephen talks about the color palette in this movie being so blue and gray. The color palette in Catch Me If You Can is so much fun and so kind of, it's so much fun. I'm always sad. I know he likes making these kind of important, it's not a new turn. It's a turn he made back at like Schindler's List.
Sure,
and
sure.
I'm not, I miss him making like fun movies. I admit, not just totally whimsical movies, but like anything with any joy.
There is something interesting in the influence of the Coen brothers who helped polish the screenplay, because in a way it feels like, I read a review that called this a merger of Spielberg and their sensibility, and I actually felt it was more of a mashup, like the way in that music full peaks of the song come out and full peaks of another song come out. And there were genuine moments where I turned to my husband, I was like, wait, was this is this a funny moment or a serious moment? And
like, what felt Coen brothersy to you in this movie?
I thought a lot of the stuff they did in East Germany, or as in the creation of East Germany, was sort of played for that of like wacky communist bureaucrats. What do they mean? You know, and it's like, but actually, you're telling me this is a high stakes moment. There was some tonal things that every once in a while didn't totally work for me, because then in other elements of the movie, it was so Rockwell painting, fade to black. patriotism and like not funny that I wasn't always sure what they wanted out of the film, really.
Yeah, I agree with the tonal imbalance. There are some jokes, and there's certainly an element of wryness to it. I think that Mark Rylance's performance is so important to this movie, not only because he's got this wonderful presence, but he's dry to the point of wryness in a way that I enjoy. But that is set against Spielberg very often lean on his score.
Yeah.
In this case, it's not John Williams. It's Thomas Newman. You get these like string swells at times that just undercut any of that lightness.
Mm-hmm.
And Rylance does so much with so little, with just his face. And for people who are Wolf Hall fans like me, where he plays Thomas Cromwell, there's so much he does on that TV show that is so quiet and holds your attention. And I thought for a movie like this one that is trying to build on the idea of tension, I could have hung out all day in his apartment painting and watching him do spy stuff on the side.
Yeah.
Like, let's do Saturday with Colonel Abel. You know?
And he has a legitimately interesting attitude toward both the work that he's doing and toward being captured. It continues to kind of be unexpected, I think.
Yeah. The fact that we meet Tom Hanks, his character, we meet him when he is an insurance guy who is rejecting a claim, a very valid claim on a technicality, that is playing against the Tom Hanks type. I mean, he is Jimmy Stewart. He is Henry Fonda. He's Gregory Peck.
Right.
He's Glenn Ford. He's always the guy. We'll talk about this more in the next segment, I'm sure. But he is this stolid American citizen. And for us to be introduced that way, it comes back later, of course. And that's part of why we were introduced to him that way. It was an interesting technique on paper. But the likability, the genetic likability of Tom Hanks just kind of carried this movie so much.
But that's the kind of thing I found slightly disingenuous, right?
Yeah.
It's like the guy was at the Nuremberg trials. Why are we pretending he was, you know, like just an insurance adjuster?
Yeah.
Right.
He was into the American way. It's like, what? No.
Right.
Super savvy, interesting person, lots of experience.
Yeah.
Like, obviously not as aw shucks as this was sort of making it out to be.
Yeah. I think we talked when we talked about Captain Phillips, maybe, talked about the fact that casting Tom Hanks does a lot of the work in creating that character. And I think it's true here, too, that he's one of those people, and we'll talk about this more in our other segment, but he's one of those people where once you cast him, you say a lot just in that casting, because he's not one of these guys who disappears into characters and can be anybody. He's somebody who usually is within, at least in this stage of his career, is usually playing a guy within a certain relatively small spread of humanity,
right?
The other thing this movie made me think about was, what am I going to the movies for? Because there was nothing about this movie that I could say wasn't well done. There was nothing about this movie that I could say I didn't think a person who's into this kind of movie could legitimately go and enjoy it and all that stuff. And I thought, it makes me restless to feel like I'm watching something that I don't know why it needs to be. I don't know what the passionate creative drive to make this movie would be, because I feel like there are so many movies that are so much like this that already exist, kind of
like what?
But do they exist now though?
I don't know.
And I think that's one of the interesting things about this. When I wrote in my notes, I mean, like you all, I wrote old fashioned, but I sort of also wrote like that's its curse and its blessing a little bit. Like there aren't a lot of movies being made like this, and in a sense, there is an audience that is clearly being underserved. There is an audience for this movie.
Absolutely. And the fact that this is an adult aimed drama, that's all wonderful. I'm happy to see stuff in that kind of like what they consider to be like the middle range. It's not a tiny little indie, but it's not blockbuster. And they don't make very many movies like that. This is why I'm so conflicted about it. I just felt like I was instantly going to forget I ever saw it.
Yeah.
It was like, it happened. I saw it. It's fine. It's good. It's Steven Spielberg.
Well, I think the history buffs will definitely like it. And I will say, having been in Berlin actually earlier this year and seen remnants of the wall and how that city reconciles with its history, how it's on display everywhere, I got a total kick out of seeing this tiny sliver, literally these weeks of history being put on film, you know, like brick by brick of the wall going
up. The more specific it was about the history, the more I enjoyed it.
And the train passing. Yeah. And even in the opening set piece, they're in a New York subway. And it's created in a way that I found so sort of charming and engaging and not Mad Men, wink, wink. Like, look at all the props we found, you know? Like,
and not flashy or particularly stylish.
Yeah, I felt like, we're in the summer sweaty New York subway of, you know, 1962. Mm-hmm. And I thought those moments, I did kind of relish those moments when I was in them. And like you said, have that moment where you're like, oh, this is just good filmmaking on display.
That's it. Because for everybody who calls this film old-fashioned, there's going to be somebody else who calls it classic. Right. And they're going to be sitting across my Thanksgiving table and they're going to be 60 years old.
And you'll be ready.
And I'll be ready for it.
Yeah. And I specifically, as I was walking out of this movie, I was thinking about the word old-fashioned. And I was thinking about, I really want that word to be something that can be considered neither positive nor negative. It just is. It just is a movie that, as Glenn said, could have been made in 1962 to a great degree. And I kept sitting there thinking, I love going to the movies and seeing something that feels a little more high energy than this. Mm-hmm. And I just got kind of, I got a little bored.
You're right. And there were plenty of times when it would just like fade to black. And I, in my mind, I was like, oh, yeah, I remember when people used to fade to black. Like, because I'm so used to, like, the trailers before this movie were insane because they were all, like, based on true events type trailers. Yeah. And they were cut within an inch of their life. Like, no moment was too minor to be like, dun, 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 the moment. And you're
the
just
one
like,
where the boat breaks in
half. You're like, what are these things about? I don't even know. And then all of a sudden, this little movie followed these trailers. Yeah.
Every bullet that was fired in this movie wound up in the trailer.
And I think one thing that happens in this movie is there's so much business that has to be moved into place before. Because ultimately, the transaction that's at stake, when you talked about the actual Bridge of Spies, the transaction that's going on there involves a whole bunch of things that have to have already happened, for which you have to have been brought along and that you have to care about by then already. So a lot of this movie is moving all those pieces into place. And I felt like once you got to the end, it paid off and it was satisfying. But moving up to there, I cared about certain parts a lot more than others. There's a young student who kind of gets a little bit dragged into this. And he was actually the person that I found the most instantly compelling. Among other things, as they point out, he's not a pilot and he's not a spy. He's just a kid who is being detained as a pawn. So in a way, he's the most sympathetic person among all these people being traded, but he's the person who's not really the point. Right. And I was curious about that kid and I wanted to kind of know a little bit more about him, but they're doing so much and it's already 2 hours and 21 minutes long. So how much more Frederick did I really want? That's the question. All right. Well, I will be curious to see what all of you who have seen Bridge of Spies think, and if your relatives have seen it as of Thanksgiving, what they think of it as well. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter at NPRPCHH. Well, when we come back, we've been talking about Tom Hanks. We're going to talk a little more about Tom Hanks, the comedy, the drama, the TV, the movies. So stick around.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Makespace. For people who dream about having a bigger closet and never want to visit a storage unit again, Makespace is like having an infinite closet. Here's how it works. Makespace picks up your stuff for free. They take it to storage for you, and they bring it back whenever you want. And now Makespace is giving all listeners $50 of free storage. Just schedule a pickup at makespace.com or download the Makespace app and enter promo code POP.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about the new Steven Spielberg film, Bridge of Spies, which stars Tom Hanks. We thought we'd talk a little more about Tom Hanks. Now, if you've been following this gentleman for a while, you know he goes all the way back to television comedy. He goes all the way back to sitcoms. He goes all the way back to Bosom Buddies. Am I right, Glenn?
The date. Thursday, November 27th, 1980.
Oh, my God.
The time, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. The network, the American Broadcasting Company, sandwiched there between Mork and Mindy and Barney Miller.
Yep.
Hit me one time, Jessica Reedy.
I don't believe I've seen you two around here before.
No, you haven't. We just got in from Canada.
Yes, two Canadian girls in the big city, just like Margaret Trudeau.
Oh, heavens me, I have been so rude, I haven't introduced us. This is my sister, Hildegard.
Hildegard.
And this is my sister, Buffy.
All right, so the premise, he and Peter Scolari are two straight dudes in the big city, and they need to get an apartment for very cheap. So for reasons far too Byzantine to go into, they decide to dress up as women. This show was created to be the male version of Laverne and Shirley. The producers went to the network and said, we want to do something that's just a buddy comedy, kind of Billy Wilder-like, you know, sophisticated. And the network, being an American television network, said, who's Billy Wilder? And they said, well, have you seen Some Like It Hot?
Sure.
And then the network said, oh, so they're going to be in drag? Great.
Is that what happened?
That's what happened. And then they go.
Where do you know this from?
I know.
There's an interview back.
Okay.
So they go back and say, holy crap, we need to make a show about drag.
Okay.
And you can feel it in the bones of this show, because this show is built on the chemistry between Tom Hanks and Peter Scolari. It is joke dense. It holds up, I tell you.
Mm-hmm.
The gayest thing about the show, even though it's all about drag, is the presence of Holland Taylor.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed. The wonderful Holland Taylor.
And within this, it had two very short seasons. The second season, they pretty much dispensed with the whole drag thing, and it just became about these two guys.
It was only two seasons?
Yeah. Only two seasons.
See, like syndication makes you think that things go on for... I remember feeling like I watched 1,000 episodes.
I know, right?
Of Cousin Lies. Mm-hmm.
And he was great, but again, the interaction between these two guys, the fact that it leaned so hard into improv, and you can kind of tell in some of the later episodes, and I venture to say that the bottle episode where they go to a mountain cabin, just the two of them, is the best bottle episode in sitcom history. It's very, very funny. Most of these episodes are up on YouTube right now. But then after that, in 82, he does Mazes and Monsters, which is a television movie that is to Dungeons and Dragons as Reefer Madness is to pot. It's about how terrifying and how it will corrupt your kids' minds, and he plays a kid who freaks out. Then a really good turn on Family Ties.
Uncle Ned.
Uncle Ned, playing the alcoholic. Was he an alcoholic uncle?
The first time he came on Family Ties, he was, Uncle Ned was just a guy who had gotten involved in some financial shenanigans. And
I just want to say, you are all dating yourselves right now.
Oh, yeah.
So bad. We have planted a flag for the late-term Gen X, pre-millennial window of 5 years.
I don't mind. Yeah, he was playing Uncle Ned. The first time that he was on, he was just like uncovered bad business ethics at his big business job and all that. The second time he was on was when they did the Uncle Ned is an Alcoholic storyline.
Tom Hanks is in 50 blockbuster movies.
I know. And listen to this discussion. Stephen, I am with you.
We're getting there.
Because as soon as he starts with the blockbuster movies, I start to lose interest in the guy.
This is an interesting trajectory. Keep going, Glenn Weldon. I am here for you.
So he shows up as a guest on Letterman a lot, and he's very funny and quick and witty. And then Splash happens.
Right.
And that's pretty much where he kind of turns his back on television pretty much for good.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's true.
Then follows things like Nothing in Common, where he tries to be serious with Jackie Gleason.
Jackie Gleason, yeah.
The first time he tries to be serious, and then...
There's a little run of junk there,
yes.
Right? There's a little run of stuff that doesn't work very well. The Money Pit. You like The Money Pit.
I say The Money Pit is hugely underrated.
You like The Money Pit, but I'm saying The Money Pit was not perceived as Tom Hanks is a huge star because of The Money Pit, right?
True that.
So then he goes along...
to Joe versus the Volcano.
Well, no. You skipped a small movie called Big.
Yeah.
Whatever. In 1988.
I'm aware of its work.
Okay.
But why would you skip that?
Here's what I'm going to tell you about Big. I don't care whether you like Big or not, mm-hmm. right? Clearly, Glenn Weldon does not like Big. But Big is the movie that essentially he makes Splash in 84, and then he makes a bunch of stuff that people don't think is necessarily working fantastically well.
Mm-hmm.
Then he makes Big in 88, and that carries him through making a bunch more stuff that people don't necessarily think works very well.
Right.
Even if it's beloved now, and in some cases weirdly, and Joe versus the Volcano is great, right?
It is great.
Joe versus the Volcano is great, and that's the first movie with Meg Ryan. A lot of people think Sleepless in Seattle is the first movie with Meg Ryan, but it is not. Joe versus the Volcano is. So does Big and then gets all the way through Joe versus the Volcano and other stuff not being commercially successful.
Well, yeah,
you
have Joe versus the Volcano and Bonfire of the Vanities, both in 1990.
Right, exactly.
When it seems like Tom Hanks is not necessarily going to be the major star that he was cracking
up. And then he makes it to 1992. And between 1992, this is the one that even knowing how his career went, I was surprised looking at this. that from 1992 to 1994, just in that run, he made A League of Their Own, Sleepless in Seattle, Philadelphia, and Forrest Gump. And after that, he was
Apollo 13. Well,
what else do you need to do?
Apollo 13 was 95. Philadelphia and Forrest Gump were his two Oscars, right?
Yes.
Those were back-to-back. And after that, I think he could do whatever he wanted, right?
I mean, what else do you monsters want? Those are like two amazing years.
After that, it got to be, then you got Apollo 13 and you got Toy Story, which
still
is
good,
hugely
still
important.
Good.
And That Thing You Do, which many people love. Mm-hmm. And then he started making Saving Private Ryan and all that stuff. And after that, he was a gigantic, pretty much untouchable star.
And basically, once you're around Forrest Gump and Philadelphia, you get to the point where Tom Hanks is the mayor of Hollywood.
Right.
Yeah.
And Tom Hanks can turn up at the end of an awards show and give out, you know, the best picture winner because he comes out and he's the guy everybody loves.
Yeah, and I on that point, I have a clip that I want Jessica to play that's a recent clip, just happened this week, that is Tom Hanks on Jimmy Fallon. And what they did is they gave a bunch of children the title Bridge of Spies and told them to write a scene that would be from the movie Bridge of Spies. And then Jimmy Fallon and Tom Hanks acted out the scene from the children's script of Bridge of Spies. So hit me, Jess.
There was once a bridge that was full of spies. A man walked up to it. What is this?
What does it look like? Dummy. It's a bridge of spies. Go away. We're spying.
Can I be a spy?
No. This bridge is too full of spies already. There's not room for any more.
Who are you spying on?
Each other.
How?
You sure ask a lot of questions for someone who is not a spy.
Pretty good.
So this is Tom Hanks and Jimmy Fallon messing around. If you know, Tom Hanks...
I would have seen that movie, by the way.
Right. Yes.
I mean...
Absolutely.
And Tom Hanks also used to come to the Television Critics Association Awards because he used to get nominated. For a while, he was getting nominated regularly for the stuff he was producing for HBO,
right, sure.
The Earth to the Moon and all that. And he's always just so charming and nice, and everybody likes him and talks about how nice of a dude he is. He is the mayor of Hollywood. Like Steven said, at some point he crossed over and became the mayor of Hollywood.
He is also, while we were on Tom Hanks's IMDb page, the least surprising bit of casting in the history of filmmaking is that Tom Hanks is slated to star as Sully.
Yeah.
In a movie about...
Audie's nodding like story checks
story
out.
Checks out.
Yeah.
Like, once that happened, you had to know that Tom Hanks was eventually going to be in a movie.
I don't know. Audie, you seem to be here to represent for the youth. how do you feel about
those
Tom
of us who've seen Hanks movies after 1992?
Yes.
Or just what we call Tom Hanks movies.
Yes.
No, I'm a Buzzin' Buddy fan as much as everyone else. Like, I love that as well, that informed, like,
I don't
my
believe
love
you.
Of him. It was. I didn't understand it. It came on TV. All right, we're getting... So here's the thing. I love Tom Hanks. We talked to him once for the show because he's, like, really into typewriters.
Yep.
And he made these, like, keyboards for iPad and, like, sent me a selfie. And, like, you're right. He's charming. And I remember once you had Gene Denby on saying that Will Smith was turning into the, like, high school vice principal.
The vice principal
of Hollywood.
Yeah, it's true.
And, like, Tom Hanks is, like, the cool dad, basically, in the neighborhood. Here's the thing. Is there such thing as a Tom Hanks movie? He's made so many movies, so many roles. Yes, it's a range of characters, but it's not like when I look at Jerry Maguire and I go, oh, yeah, this is basically a Tom Cruise movie. Like, no one else could do it. Mm-hmm. The whole thing rests on, like, fundamentally his personality and character. Somehow in playing the everyman, he could be any man.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bunch of Tom Hanks movies in the later years that I'll watch 1,000 times, like Catch Me If You Can and even The Green Mile, because I'm like, Tom Hanks, shrug, you know? And then there's other stuff that I'm like, this is garbage, you know? Like, that I were like, he and Julia Roberts are on a scooter or something,
or he's got
some weird accent and he's trapped in the airport.
Yep.
And I'm like, you know what? Tom Hanks has to pay his mortgage too. I'm just going to let that go.
I don't think he has too much trouble.
I was going to say, it would have to be a pretty big
I'm trying to give an excuse because really.
like
some of those films are just so bad.
Well, here's my question. When you say, is there such a thing as a Tom Hanks movie? I do feel, when I tried to isolate like what I think of as the Tom Hanks persona, it's decency, right? Which is what people always say.
That's a good
right?
word.
It's decency, and it's, but it's also, and this is true of George Clooney as well, I will say, it's decency and a little bit of sadness, right? There's always a little bit of regret. And Catch Me If You Can has that. That guy turns out to be someone who's divorced and feels acutely that loss and doesn't necessarily talk about it a whole lot. Clooney is the same way, except Clooney is doing dashing and sad, and
which involves a lot of winking
the time,
yeah.
Whereas Hanks is doing decent and sad. And I pulled a clip that's actually from Sleepless in Seattle that I think, for me, represents some of what he has brought to movies where there is that decency, there's that sadness, and there's the very American idea that there's also a sense of duty that you kind of have to go on no matter what. So this is when he is on the phone with the radio psychiatrist by whom he is originally referred to as Sleepless in Seattle.
Well, I'm going to get out of bed every morning, breathe in and out all day long. And then after a while, I won't have to remind myself to get out of bed in the morning and breathe in and out. And then after a while, I won't have to think about how I had it great and perfect for a while.
So what he's describing there in this movie that's ultimately going to be very romantic is literally a duty to get up every day and breathe in and out, because he has a kid, because he has to go on, because he's very sad, he's lost his wife. And I think that sense of duty and weight is part of what has made him a different kind of everyman than some kind of wackier everyman guys.
Well, and I think it's interesting. If you look at his trajectory, I've often said like that comedians tend to ultimately be more versatile than so-called dramatic actors, that comedy tends to naturally give you a little bit of a broader range. And if you look at some of those early roles, and I particularly target Big, which is a movie I love. Glenn, you're aware of its work, whatever. None of this is surprising.
Send your emails to Glenn Hates Big.
I think it says something about the way that an aw-shucks persona can age, that an aw-shucks persona, a youthful aw-shucks persona, has a note of innocence to it. And Big is all, you know, he's a naif. He is all about innocence. And innocence as a young person has a way of aging into integrity. And I think that the innocence that he's able to convey as a young actor, there's a very natural through line to these like man of decency, man of integrity roles that he tends, you know, he's Captain Phillips, he's James B. Donovan.
Captain Phillips basically is Sully in many ways.
Exactly.
But here's the thing, right? That kind of youthful, fun dude can also age into being kind of glib, right? Because, I mean, we talk a lot about Splash and we talk about stuff like that, but he was also in Bachelor Party early.
Right.
And I think the persona from Bachelor Party and even Bosom Buddies could have gone a different direction and could have kind of turned into glib, sloppy, you know.
This makes me wonder what's going to happen to Ed Helms.
Yeah. That's true. He is kind of a contemporary.
Let's think about
that. Let me bring in another perspective here, because I happen to know that rarest of human species, the guy who harbors a pitched loathing for Tom Hanks, who will avoid a Tom Hanks film just because Tom Hanks is in it, and that I am married to him. And so last night I sat him down and I asked, where is this coming from?
Yeah.
Who are you? And because Tom Hanks was genetically engineered underneath a lab to be genial, to be charming. What is it about him? And this launched him into a lecture about how, you know, he was a women's studies major and Meryl Streep does all these different things. Tom Hanks only does the one thing, he said.
I think
only,
that's sort of true.
Only does the one thing. And I said to him, you're comparing apples to fruit salad, right? You can't, because she does a lot of different things. He's an apple and he does the one thing. Now, when he doesn't do that one thing, it doesn't work. When he is venal and greedy in Bonfire of the Vanities, when he's many different things, whatever the hell he was doing, in Cloud Atlas. And
oh, that accent.
Let's forget the Lady Killers, but let's bring it into this part of the conversation. He's just, it doesn't work, because we expect that Glenn Ford, Henry Fonda, Gregory Peck, Jimmy Stewart stolidness. And that's what makes a Tom Hanks film, is the presence of exactly what you guys are describing.
I think that's fair. And I've talked before about a theory that my friend Sarah Bunting talked about with actors, that some actors are great because they can do a whole bunch of different things, and other ones are more vertical. Like other ones, their range is more vertical. They can do a lot of different things with one part, but not necessarily across a lot of different parts. And she, it's interesting to draw a line between Tom Hanks and James Gandolfini because they're very different in some ways. But she applied that theory to James Gandolfini because you don't necessarily see him playing all kinds of different people like Meryl Streep would. But that within the character, like within the kind of character that he played, he found a lot of different things to do. And I think if you watch a movie like Catch Me If You Can, that is really one of my favorite Tom Hanks movies. And I think one of the best arguments for him as a movie star. I'm a little in love with that movie right now. But I think if you watch that movie, he's doing a lot of things with that kind of man in overcoat and hat. And it takes place very much at the only a handful of years after the Bridge of Spies stuff. It's the same time period for the most part. And he does do a lot of interesting things with that guy. His relationship with the Leonardo DiCaprio con man character is interesting. And there's lots of stuff in there. But do I think you should cast Tom Hanks as your bad guy? No, not really. And I think he has tried a couple times to do bad guys or to do ugly people, and I don't necessarily think that's worked terribly well. He is that guy. He is the guy in Saving Private Ryan, who is basically the guy in Apollo 13, another movie in which I love him and think he's great, but he's basically also Sully.
Sully. he always has been Sully. He always will be Sully.
It's isn't this also true of Jimmy Stewart?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And I mean, we don't sit here and bag on Jimmy Stewart. Jimmy Stewart.
Yes.
No, absolutely. I agree.
But that role is an old-fashioned role. That idea of you have the guy who does the thing. I mean, Jack Nicholson, sure, he does the thing, but he's a very stylized
thing.
He's
a movie star.
Yes.
This is part of it. He's a movie star. And this is one of the things where, you know, so's Clooney. So are certain other people. It's a matter of being good at being a movie star. Well, I think that many people will probably tell us that Glenn is wrong to hate Big. And some...
Wait, you don't hate Big.
Some may say that Audie is wrong to hate The Terminal.
Wow. Wait, Glenn is not...
Glenn really does not like Big. But
not,
we will wait
for
to
me. As Audie said, it's not for me.
We will wait to hear from all of you out there about your favorite Tom Hanks movies and whether you think we are way off the mark about any of these performances. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company dedicated to helping clients achieve lifelong financial well-being. An award-winning global asset manager, TIAA CREF was founded nearly a century ago to serve those who serve others in the academic, medical, cultural, governmental, and research fields. Its investment model and long-term approach are aimed at delivering outcomes that benefit clients. TIAA CREF, created to serve and built to perform at TIAA.org. TIAA CREF Individual and Institutional Services, LLC.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Linda, I know you are a fan of the sports writer Joe Posnanski.
Yes, he is also our friend Mike Katz's favorite sports writer.
Nice.
So,
well, yeah. I can see why. I was not terribly familiar with his work. He writes about baseball a lot.
He does.
I don't read
about
baseball a lot.
He does write a lot.
But he teamed up with Michael Schur, who is your favorite, I believe, human.
Oh, quiet. He is a comedy showrunner and producer. He worked on The Office, and he worked on Parks and Rec, and he worked on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. He's working on Aziz Ansari's new show and has a couple of other new shows coming up. And he used to maintain a blog called Fire Joe Morgan anonymously with some other people, which was super, super funny, making fun of sports media.
Okay, so these are two of your favorite people.
They are.
And this piece is, what would you say, 6,000-7,000 words?
It's super long.
Super long, about one inning of one baseball game.
Uh-huh.
And Glenn is smiling and nodding at me because 6,000 or 7,000 words about one inning of a baseball game sounds great to you.
Yeah.
But it is about a bonkers inning of a major league playoff game.
A few days ago,
between the Blue Jays and the Texas Rangers. Mm-hmm. And their description of these goofy plays that just escalate into mayhem. And there's this, to give you a sample at one point, they have described this incredibly bonkers play that no one has ever seen before. And it turns out that they are able to check the rules to make sure what is supposed to happen in this game. And it turns out that there is, as they describe, an exact description of this exact play as it exactly happens. And then comes the pertinent part, quote, "However, if the batter is standing in the batter's box and he or his bat is struck by the catcher's throw back to the pitcher or throw in attempting to retire a runner, and in the umpire's judgment there is no intent on the part of the batter to interfere with the throw, the ball is alive and in play."
That's exactly what happened.
And that is literally exactly what happened. So then that is word for word what happened. Look at that rule. It's a miracle. It's like finding some scroll in the Dead Sea Scroll, opening it up, and finding in Aramaic the lyrics of "Watch me whip Nene."
Oh, that piece is so good.
It is so good. And part of what I love about it, it's obviously it's very digressive. There is this mixture of a little bit of eye rolling about baseball with intense and passionate and caring love of baseball.
Right.
And so it is such a wonderful piece of sports writing that reads like an IM chat between, I mean, I would like to think between me and you, Linda, but there's no way we could not have pulled this off.
No, absolutely
not. It is wonderful. We will link to it on the blog. It's called Flipping Out on NBC Sports World by Joe Posnanski and Michael Schur.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. Everyone should read it. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. I approve of your choice. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. The AV Club writer John Teddy has a podcast with his mom, and at some point in the recent past, they watched an episode of the Comedy Central show Nathan For You. Now, the premise of Nathan For You is that the comedian Nathan Fielder goes to a small business that is struggling, offers them an idea, helps them do it, to try to turn their business around. It's on Comedy Central, which means Nathan Fielder is a comedian. The idea he comes up with are terrible. And the tension of the show is to see if these people will pretend like it's a good idea, how far they'll go along with it, what they'll actually do. He's also creating a character that's kind of a larger-than-life version of himself as a guy who isn't good with people and just is sort of off-putting in various ways. So this writer and his mom watch the show. The mom hates it, can't stand it. And I'm paraphrasing here basically because she finds the whole thing just smug and superior, and that the guy of Nathan Fielder is insincere, and she just doesn't like what the show is about, what it's doing. Now, that criticism is two things simultaneously. A, it's generational. A person of this woman's age may not, you know, just react well to this kind of humor. B, it is a fair critique of this show.
Yeah.
A really fair critique of this show.
And it represents how a lot of people feel about prank comedy.
Exactly. Right. And I like the show a lot. People who love the show are the ones who kind of tune in to watch the real people look like fools. I watch it because I really like what Nathan Fielder is doing with that persona. So last week, the AV Club arranged to do an interview with Fielder because Nathan For You came back for its third season last week. Fielder came back and said, "Can I do the interview with your mom?" Because he apparently had heard the podcast. It's called Nathan For You's Star Confronts the AV Club Mom Who Scorned Him.
Mm-hmm.
And this very long interview goes on for quite some time.
It does.
And it goes in all kinds of weird directions. And it is sincere and it's funny. It ends up in a kind of a sweet place at the end of it. And it's just a great read. I highly recommend it. Second thing is Paul F. Tompkins' Comedy Central special, stand-up special, came out last week called Crying and Driving. Look, you're listening to a podcast right now. Odds are better than even that you've heard of Paul F. Tompkins.
Yep.
But if there's anybody out there who has not heard of this guy or has not yet seen this special, I just implore you to watch it. I watch a lot of stand-up specials, and I smile politely through them because I enjoy comedy. I enjoy stand-up comedy. I can't remember the last time I was sitting alone in the den with tears rolling down my big dumb face, snot pouring out my nose, and hoots of laughter that startled the dog. His comedy tends to be observational, outward-looking. Here, it does feel like an evolution. I would watch him do what he's been doing for years, mm-hmm. 4 years. He's turning inward, and there's a new note of self-mocking, humorous self-laceration that is many things, but it's new for him, and it feels like it's an evolution, as I say. So that is Crying and Driving by Paul F. Tompkins.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Audie Cornish, what is making you happy this week, ma'am?
This is not new, but it's making me happy, so I'm going to mention it, which is this song by this artist named Lapsley. And she's, like, I think 1920. She's British, kind of does electronic music, and the song is called Hurt Me. And it's the kind of thing where I heard it one time, and I thought, oh, this is okay. And then, like, 600 times later, I realized I was, like, belting it out in the car by myself.
So if you're gonna hurt me, why don't you hurt me a little bit more? Just dig a little deeper, push a little harder than before. And I'm counting down the seconds that we have. I can see the end inside the lights. So if you're gonna hurt me, why don't you hurt me a little bit more?
I don't know, it was just a thing that really brought me a lot of joy recently, so I wanted to share. And then the thing that's making me cautiously optimistic is the trailer for the live-action Jungle Book, which I saw actually before Bridge of Spies, and I hadn't seen yet. And, you know, at first I was confused, and then I was appalled, and then I was intrigued, because this takes Jungle Book and turns it into this, like, dark, thrilling jungle adventure, and it's the kind of film where, number one, it looks like the special effects could actually be useful instead of mind-numbing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're making animals talk, and it's, like, real-looking animals. And the other thing is, I feel like this is a genuine challenge for Disney. You know, Kipling, the story to begin with, is problematic in a lot of ways. The Disney animated feature is both beloved and cringe-inducing. And how do you do this without the jive-talking monkeys, you know? And what is this really going to look like? And the number of people who have signed up for it, you know, whether it's, like, Ben Kingsley or Scarlett Johansson or Lupita Nyong'o, there's a lot of people who kind of got involved in this film who I respect their judgment movies. And so I have high hopes for this. And I think Disney has really done a lot of interesting work with Cinderella and all this other stuff, making things live action. So Jungle Book, it's like April 2016. I mean, I am way jumping on this for some reason. But I want people to go check out the trailer and see if they're thinking the same thing I'm thinking, which is kind of like question mark, exclamation point.
Making Audie Cornish cautiously optimistic this week, the trailer for the live action Jungle Book. Thank you very much, Audie. So in lieu of using the same piece that Stephen used, which also made me very happy this week, I decided that I would mention something that I hope we're going to get back to maybe with my pal Barry Hardiman at some point, because I know she wants to talk about this. But the thing I cannot stop watching this week is the newest season of HBO's Project Greenlight, which, if you are not familiar with this show, is the documentary series where Ben Affleck and Matt Damon and a couple of other people get together, they pick a director in a competition setting to make a movie, and then you follow them making the movie. This season very early got hit with a lot of controversy because of some straight-up boneheaded stuff that Matt Damon said about diversity when confronted by a Black woman producer working on the film. Basically, she said, you should consider that this script has some problems that might benefit from the insight of somebody who is a woman or a person of color. Just consider it, right? And Damon basically said, well, diversity is something you do in casting the movie, not like picking the director. So it was basically like, it only matters when people can see it, is how it sounded,
right?
Which is really bad. So he got in a lot of hot water for that. But actually, what has developed, even though that's true and he was wrong and it was really dumb, the thing that has developed over the course of the season is this clash between this incredibly entitled, twerpy director that they picked, just my opinion, and this Black woman producer, whose name is Effie Brown, who worked on Dear White People and a couple of other big indie movies over the course of a longish career, But I'm a Cheerleader and Rocket Science and a couple of other ones. Her job, the job of the producer in this setting, is to keep the thing on budget and on time. In other words, she is the no person. That's what her job is. And this dude who came in and is chosen as the director is one of these guys who sees himself as like, but my creativity. And if you ask certain people, right, friend of the show, Scott Tobias, feels this way. This guy is sort of a hero because he is sticking to his guns, particularly about using film instead of digital. which to some people, if you insist upon using film, you are a hero who cannot stop being a hero unless you perhaps kick a dog. So he is, to some people, a real heroic figure for being unwilling to bend creatively. And I totally get that. He's also looks like a terrible person to work with and deal with. And he does not seem to have the skills to actually make that vision come true within the parameters that he's been given. And that's what her job is. Watching them kind of knock heads and seeing how differently he sees himself from how she sees him and how I see him and how Scott sees him is totally fascinating. I cannot stop watching it. My friends over at previously.tv every week write about how much they want to punch this guy in the face, and I can't really disagree, but it is a fascinating watch because, gosh, if anything I've ever watched has sent the message that how something looks depends entirely on the goggles that you're wearing when you look at it, it is this bonkers season of this show. So even though it also makes me crazy and is maddening, making me happy this week is watching a lot of Project Greenlight. That is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven and Glenn at GH Weldon. And you can follow Audie at NPR Audie. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And you can follow the show at NPR PCHH. You can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out the How to Do Everything podcast with Mike and Ian. Among other things, they help listeners find water in the desert, defend against monsters, and play a game of crud. Mike and Ian are here for you. How to Do Everything is modern life lessons from NPR. Find it now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.